I'm a firm believer that if all you ever aspire to is small incremental growth, all you'll ever see is small incremental growth, and that'll be the upper threshold of your level of achievement.
Hello and welcome to the Gross Profit Podcast. My name is James Kennedy. I'm the CEO and co-founder at ProcurementExpress.com. We take the hassle out of managing your organization's spend without buying an ERP, but we're not here to talk about that today. Instead, I've got fractional CFO Martin Meller here to talk about his experience in shepherding one of his customers through an M&A experience. We're going to go from the very start where he thought before Martin came along, maybe this was just going to be a lifestyle business. And instead, it has turned into something that could be life-changing for maybe him and his family. So it's an interesting story. It's live. It's happening. Q2 2025. You might be hearing it a little later on, but this is from the trenches as it happens. So it should be an exciting one. So Martin, you're very welcome to the podcast. Maybe you can kick us off by telling us something about you that most of your colleagues might not know about you.
Hi, James, and thanks for having me. So I guess one thing that sprang to mind that you might not know about me is that when I was 6 years old, I climbed the highest mountain in England, Scafell Pike, with my parents. I had parents who were keen walkers, and I vividly remember getting to the top of the mountain, and there were some people there kind of congratulating themselves on having made it to the top. And then they look round and there's this little runt of a boy there with his dad, and it somewhat, I suspect, tarnished their achievement in terms of getting to the top.
Very good. Yeah, I did Kilimanjaro a decade or so more ago, and you get about three quarters the way up and there's a little plaque that we were, you know, there right almost to the top, and we were feeling good at ourselves for getting that far up at all. And the plaque said, "Congratulations, you've now climbed as high as the highest attempted wheelchair attempt on Kilimanjaro." And then we instantly were deflated. So I know the feeling of those people at the top of the peak. So you have kids yourself now. So I think in those days that was not normal, but you know, today it might be called child abuse. So what have you tried to do the same thing with your own kids, and how's that going down?
Well, yeah, no, I've not forced him up any mountains, but he is a pretty active boy. So he's actually at the age that I was pretty much when I climbed Scafell Pike. No, he loves being outdoors. So we do a lot of sporty things, riding bikes and playing football and things like that, but not quite scaling the mountains like my parents used to make us do.
Very good. And I know this might be a weird segue, but oftentimes, is there anything that experience, which is an unusual experience, you bring to your day-to-day as a fractional CFO? Is there anything it taught you?
Yeah, well, so I suppose without being too trite, I guess, I think it's a demonstration that it's possible to achieve far more than you might imagine is possible, particularly if you break your journey down into smaller goals. So get to that next rock, get to that next tarn, whatever it is that breaks the journey down. And I think one of the things that I'm big on as a CFO is giving people measurable targets that don't feel outfacing, but then when you put them all together, you can achieve something way more significant. So that's probably the lesson that I would draw out from it.
Goal setting is really difficult. We find ourselves constantly either making them too easy or too hard, but getting the Goldilocks zone is really tricky. Have you any advice for me there? Because we rarely get it right. We'll be lucky. Sometimes it feels like no one hits their rock. We won't do quarterly rocks. And sometimes it feels like we all walked it. And it was like, trying to get the Goldilocks zone is difficult.
Yeah.
Have you any advice on me?
Well, I think several things. You're right. That kind of just right sweet spot is challenging. I think ultimately it all stems from, and this will link into part of the conversation that we'll probably have later on, is where are you trying to get to? In the bigger picture, where are you trying to get to? And I'm a firm believer that if all you ever aspire to is small incremental growth, all you'll ever see is small incremental growth, and that'll be the upper threshold of your level of achievement. So I think sometimes what you have to do is kind of park what's believable and achievable and think about something that feels totally out of your comfort zone, totally beyond the realms of possibility. And it's not that should then be the target necessarily, but it's that'll help you to understand, if you think about what would it take for us to achieve this crazy target, behaviorally, you start to get your brain into a place that pushes beyond the constraint of, it's called the theory of constraints, but it pushed beyond the constraint of, well, what feels reasonable, you know, is 2%, 3%, whatever it is. And I think equally, the other thing that I would always say to bear in mind is, and this is a truism, any forecast, any financial forecast will be wrong to some degree. It's not there to be 100% accurate. And therefore, a target isn't a real target if you beat it and achieve it every single time. That isn't the purpose of the target. The target is there to drive you, to define behavior, to give you something to focus on. And if you make it, to celebrate success. But equally, if everyone's achieving it, it suggests that probably that target was slightly low. And because actually, there's no reason why we should all achieve a target. So I think I would park what is believable, look at bigger picture, align those bigger picture goals with maybe what you're trying to do, and then be willing to fail. That's another massive part of target setting. You've got to be willing to fail. And when I say fail, there's variations of fail, isn't there? There's fail where you kind of put your head in your hands and go, oh no, we're never going to do this. That's not what I'm talking about. But if you don't quite make a target that you've set, but that target was challenging, you can still take a lot from that. But if you just set a target in order that you can beat it, it's not helping you. It's not doing anything for you.
And when you're setting targets, so we have what we call them internally as leading and lagging KPIs, right? Mm-hmm. So the target is, for us, is generally the lagging, you know, it's a sales number. Sometimes it's a product capability. Mm-hmm. It's something we want to do. And then we try measuring that is kind of, in a way, you know, you might want more sales, but what really drives this more sales is the question, and what's in your control, moreover, you know, like number of outbound calls. And sales is so easy. Everyone talks about that one because it's kind of what we all know. So when you're giving people targets, do you give like the leaders the outcome and you give the ICs the leading indicator, or how do you break it up? Does everyone work with a leading indicator?
Yeah, it's a great question. No, not everyone. So like, work out what can that individual influence in their role?
Hmm.
And how much do they need to know the end goal in order for it to make sense to them? So we've not kind of talked about work history, but back in the day, I worked with a wealth advisory business in financial services. And the way that we anchored targets for individual advisors going out and meeting customers was, we broke it down into three numbers for them, 6, 3, and 3. So the expectation was that they would meet 6 customers for the first time every week, that they would have 3 meetings that were a follow-up meeting where they would be concluding or providing advice to their customers. And as a result of those 3 meetings, we would expect them to have recommended and have signups to 3 product solutions. Didn't say how big, didn't say what value, didn't say anything more than that, 6, 3, 3. And we would report against those numbers for each individual. So last week you saw 5 customers, the week before you saw 4. And those individuals could still sign up enough business to meet their financial metric targets. That was the thing that was predominantly driving their payment, their pay. But over time, we managed to prove and we managed to share that if you consistently don't achieve those numbers, you at some point your pipeline will dry up to the extent that you'll be missing targets. And we also knew that if everyone in the business met those targets, we collectively would smash the business plan. But it was about giving people things that made sense to them, and kind of almost, you do those 3 things and everything else will take care of itself. Whereas if you were a leader of that business, obviously you had a P&L to manage, you had an outcome-based target that was driven by, but it's what does the individual helps them focus on the task at hand and what helps them drive the behavior that results in the outcome.
Yeah, very good. I mean, we'll get on to that on your business win a little later on, but you started off with, I just want to say what I like about that is it's pretty quickly, you know, because we're very numbers driven in the finance team, I guess. But very quickly it turns into, like, I love that, you know, 633, what's communicable, what's kind of catchy in a way, and you quickly you're into influence, right? Mm-hmm. And because, you know, we've, I don't know if you've ever experienced this, if someone proudly displays a giant spreadsheet with 600 rows in it that they've worked on for, you know, days and months and years on, and they're very proud of it, but it's totally undecipherable to anyone else because they've lived in the Augusta, and you have to bring it down to that like 633 sort of catchphrase, if you like. I love that. So you started off at BAE Systems. That's a big defence contractor, right? But we should mention you're in the north of England. Is that right? Was that where you?
I am. I'm in the north of England. Yeah, I'm in Yorkshire. Although that job was, so in those days it was called British Aerospace. It became BAE Systems whilst I was there. It was a graduate scheme, and I was placed at a business in the Midlands, in the West Midlands. And it was part of the Royal Ordnance Division. And basically, to kind of massively oversimplify, that business made the part of a missile that goes bang, the thing that kind of gets it off the ground or off the aircraft or whatever. So it's called a rocket motor. But that's they. It was a graduate scheme that enabled me to become a chartered accountant, a management accountant.
Very good. So sort of a blue chip start to your career. Yeah. I'd imagine those graduate schemes are fairly competitive to be able to get into. And did you pick BAE over a more traditional route, or what made you go for BAE versus PwC?
So probably slight bit of context. I hadn't studied finance or accounting. I studied law at university. And so I came out of university knowing one thing, and that was that I didn't want to be a lawyer. And so
close call.
But equally, you know, kind of almost up to that point, and certainly the way education used to work, all the careers guidance, my whole focus had been, I'm going to go do law and then I'm going to become a lawyer. So you sit there and you kind of go, right, what am I going to do? What am I any good at? And so my horizons broadened in terms of graduate schemes and things like that. And basically, I was pretty numeric, like not in a hugely academic mathematical sense, but in a kind of mental maths and kind of commerciality, I guess, interested me. So I looked into various schemes. So I didn't want to be an auditor. I didn't want to be a big four accountant type accountant. I wanted the connect, even at that stage, I wanted the connection to be to business. And so it's a really important distinction for me that means very little to people that are not financial, is that I'm a management accountant. I'm not a certified accountant. So I'm not a preparer of financial reports, compliance reports. I'm an analyzer of financial performance and the connection to the achievement of the goals of whatever business. So in that sense, it becomes then, you know, in many ways, it's about which big businesses offer schemes where you can become a chartered management accountant. And so the process with pretty much all of them was you'd be apply, go through some kind of process, and then ultimately end up at what they called an assessment centre, where you'd be with other people potentially going to be on the same graduate scheme. And if you're lucky enough, you get through that process and get offered a role. So the BAE one, it was a brilliant scheme. It was a brilliant organisation to work for. It was a brilliant organisation to kind of learn. I'm still in contact with some people that I work with there, you know, nearly 30 years on. And it's an amazing organisation because you've got everything from sites that employ 15,000 people to manufacture military aircraft through to the site where I worked, fairly rural, kind of stuck away behind a big hedge so that people can't really see what you're doing, employing 350 people to make these bits that go onto missile systems. And yet, so you're part of this big thing, 50,000 people or whatever they employed, but you're also part of something relatively small and relatively local in many ways.
So your experience has got a lot of headcount in it. If I look down at it, you know, one of my most formative experiences was I worked for a company called Broadcom, which is a subsidiary of Ericsson, an R&D company. And I look around now and we were all very fresh-faced, nubile characters there when we joined. And when I look on the LinkedIn every now and again, I go like, oh, that guy's whatever, CEO of this now, or he's doing whatever. And it's funny to look back now where everyone came from. And I believe your next big experience was with the next group when it came to building a contact center. What did you learn from that? Maybe tell me a bit more about it.
I mean, I would say it was the most formative career decision I've made. There've probably been two formative career decisions. One was doing that, and then the other one is when I decided to work for myself. So next group, owned an outsourced contact center provider. That stemmed from the fact that before they were called Next, they were called Hepworth Tailors. Hepworth Tailors were the first kind of clothing retailer in the country that would enable people to buy their Sunday best three-piece suit on credit and pay for it over multiple weeks. And so they needed a mechanism to collect those payments. And from that stemmed a contact center business, which has subsequently been bought by Capita. And so again, like massive. It was into what was called the commercial finance function was the role. And this is the reason, like you mentioned, the formative stuff. So A, in terms of network of people that I was working with, you know, fairly young, in our early mid-20s, lots of us back in my home city of Leeds, you know, sort of that work hard, play hard type balance. But purely in terms of the job and the role, there was a team that did the mechanics of the finance for the business, but we were in this almost hybrid sales environment where we worked really closely with the business development teams. And the fundamentals of the job was, how can we provide these contact center services to these clients? And we're talking about some massive, massive businesses that we run the contact centers for. O2, British Gas, Royal Bank of Scotland, Department of Work and Pensions, all sorts of enormous organizations. How could we provide those services with the highest level of care, but also the highest level of profitability? And fundamentally, that job was about, how can you get more from less? How can we be more efficient? How can we make more money? And so the combination of that and who I was working with and my peer group that I'm still heavily in contact with changed my focus, changed my understanding of the commerciality of businesses massively. Wasn't there that long, really, in the grand scheme of things? Because it's almost like that they were, in my opinion, ahead of their game, in that they empowered us as young people, these things. It's weird, in hindsight now, I realise quite how young the whole management team was. The board of directors were young, and we were empowered to go and do things. And of course, the flip side to that is, once you've empowered people and you've shown them the way, they've suddenly got a skill set that's hugely valuable elsewhere, and probably for more money than they can afford to pay you. So there was quite a high turnover of people through that environment, because you go in, you do all these things, you gain all this amazing experience that then makes you very marketable as an individual.
So the way you monetize, or you'd won these deals, I guess, the traditional way was dials, I guess, or, you know, you have had a, and you came out with a sort of more of an outcome-based approach.
Yeah, that's right. So the kind of traditional model, if you like, was that you would pay for an hour of someone's time, or variations of an hour, units of time of someone answering the phone. And then the only real variables then were the volume of calls that were coming in and how long someone was on hold for, and making sure that the staffing was at an appropriate level to meet demand. But there was one particular thing where O2, the mobile phone provider, wanted to try and stop attrition of their customer base. And so they developed a thing called a retention center. And this is the thing where, say you called up and you said, why do you want to call up today? You know, the IVR, the kind of menu options. What are you looking to do today? I'm looking to end my contract, or I'm looking to leave, or I'm looking to transfer to another provider. And they would put you through to these people. And together with some pretty whizzy IT, which I had no involvement in, that would basically help the agent on the telephone understand, not in explicit terms, but it would give them a menu of things that they could offer to that customer in order to keep that customer, to retain that customer, that was driven by how valuable that customer was to O2. So it had a flex in it. And so you, James, might have been a high volume user, a highly valuable customer. And what O2 were willing to offer you to keep you was different to me as a low volume user who barely sent a text message. And the technology would enable people to do that. So it was outcome based. And so the payment structure, the contract structure, was driven off how many customers were retained, how many customers were saved, and the pieces of the jigsaw that were required to keep those people. And so almost the ideal outcome was that the customer that was of value was retained, and was retained at the lowest level of incremental sort of spend to the organization. So we haven't had to give away as many minutes or as many text bundles or whatever it was. You know, it was, you know, nowadays it would be all driven off, you know, your phone data and handsets and things like that. In those days, we're talking quite a while ago, it was less about that. It was much more about effectively your contract, you know, how many minutes you got and how many texts you got in your bundle and things like that. But it made it that the aim of O2 and the aim of Ventura, the call center company, were perfectly aligned. It was, you know, a risk reward kind of structure. If we don't retain these customers, we don't get paid. So it was just a really different structure to a deal.
Interesting. So in the SaaS world right now, things are changing quite a bit with AI and so on. And we charge per seat like most other people do. And, you know, that's kind of what people are used to, I guess. And there's a lot of talk at the moment about, well, changing to sort of an outcome-based, you know, like instead of per seat, you know, we might charge per purchase order, you know, like, and you kind of, and then the more ordering they're doing, the more they're saving in our mind, because the more, you know, you're controlling that spend. But it could be hard to convince people of that when they're used to something else, right? Yeah. So it can almost like, this is too different. I don't know. I don't buy anything else like this. They're going to be a variable cost. Did you get pushback on, because it was different, you know, just because it might well have been different, better.
Absolutely.
But like, how could you come?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And I think so much of the success of it came down to data, to
right.
data proof of the concept. And equally, we didn't get it right. The structure wasn't right initially. So it was contingent, like lots of good financial planning, it was contingent on assumptions, right? How many calls are we going to get? How many calls from this type of customer are we going to get? What are we going to be able to offer them? And so it took probably 3 iterations of that commercial structure. So the concept remained the same. The IT element remained the same. But the mechanics of what does it take to keep someone and who do you want to keep varied based on data. So what there was a challenging but supportive environment where there was a desire from both sides to get it right. Because again, as you'll well understand from the SaaS world, the cost of acquisition of a customer versus the retention of an existing customer is night and day. And so obviously in an ideal world, we're adding more in, but we're also not losing as many out the bottom. And there will only be so many opportunities. And funnily, I mean, this cropped up again in terms of that type of idea. I did some work a while back with what was at the time a subscription-based business selling hair and skin products, but to predominantly to men. So things like beard oils and waxes and this kind of stuff. And it was initially done on a subscription basis. But the reality was what it took to get people in made it really difficult to keep them. And so the burn, the attrition of that customer base was enormous. You know, they'd acquired a huge number of customers. They'd been very successful at that, but it was really hard to keep them and retain them. And so that business is now very successful, but only a small part of what it does is subscription-based. A lot of it is just more targeted retail. And again, it comes down to, lots of it came down to data and understanding cost of acquisition and cost of retention. And once you understand those things, you then understand the impact of action or inaction, right? In terms of trying to retain your base.
Well, I think you're dead right there. And this is where CFO skill set comes in, because pretty much, you know, I won't say anyone, but like a lot of what you're talking about sounds like kind of, I don't want to say art of the deal, but it sounds, I've never read the book, so I don't know, but like it sounds very sort of creative when it comes to structuring a deal. And, you know, that's typically something like a CEO or a sales leader might come up with. But then to implement that, you need the data that everyone can believe in. And that's just not straightforward, right? You need the historical data to prove that it would work. And then you need the go forward data. And that's where the CFO skill set comes in, right? To be able to put in.
Absolutely. And this is where you kind of, I first learned that what if or so what kind of view of the world of that says, look, this is what we started with as a set of assumptions. This is what actually happened. This is the outcome that we've got, but the outcome could be so much better if now we know what's actually coming in rather than it being a set of theoretical assumptions. We now have actual stuff that we can take and we can translate. And I can prove to you, I can demonstrate to you with data that we can drive these outcomes off the back of it. And it's only when you have that degree of understanding and that kind of interrogation of what's happening and the overlay of a bit like you were saying earlier on in the chat, the input versus the output, the leading versus the lagging, right? That is the connection between the two. If we get this bit right, what happens over here?
Yeah. Okay. So you've mentioned already the 366 experience, you know, design. I'm getting here that you have, you know, you have the ability to communicate. Maybe that language background in law didn't go totally wasted in your ability to sort of articulate this in a way that the team could understand. Okay, so moving to today, you've got experience with quite large businesses, but you're going through an interesting experience at the moment with a client who started off with something that could well just be a lifestyle or an ordinary business, but has an opportunity to become something quite different to that now, in part due to your help. Maybe you could just tell us a little bit about what's happening.
Yeah, sure. So the business is what's called a managed service provider, which is effectively your IT department when you don't have an internal IT department. They provide all of your software, all of your subscriptions, all of your cybersecurity, help desk. It'll even help you buy a new laptop. And that business has existed for 10, 11 years, was tracking along quite nicely, started in the founder's back bedroom, was employing maybe 15, 18 people, something like that, by 2022, somewhere around there. But it was kind of not flatlining, but it was at a level where it would have delivered a good income for the founder, but probably nothing more than that. And I think the founder was really brave. He took a really brave decision, and one that I think lots of people would be shy of, in that he got to know someone else who'd worked in that industry, who'd grown and scaled a business. And initially, the relationship started out as a consultancy basis. But the brave thing was that founder realized that he was good at certain things, but he also didn't have certain other skill sets. The second individual did have those skill sets, put those two things together, and suddenly you've got a much more powerful proposition. And so the brave thing was, you know, the old adage of 50% of something is worth way more than 100% of nothing came in. And so the second individual came in as a shareholder. And so that's kind of watershed moment number one. They were smart enough. They'd had an outsourced finance professional and then eventually had a conversation with me. I've been working with them for just over a couple of years. And at the point that I went in, we were working towards a 10-year plan, try and grow the business, add as much value as possible. They successfully started to grow. And then watershed moment number two was when they were at an industry conference and we're talking, they were sat next to somebody who'd recently bought a competitor of theirs. So this individual's role was in M&A for a much bigger version of what their business did. And they knew of the business that had been bought, and they had a conversation, and, you know, over a few drinks in the bar, the conference was in the States, and it became apparent to them the potential value of what they had and the fact that as individuals, if they could achieve certain financial metrics, it would set them up for life. And it would provide that, you know, and again, this all comes down to what do you want? And of course, the danger here is if you've got one partner that wants to do one thing and another partner that wants to do another thing, but they were both aligned, they both could see this exit point, and they could see this exit point way sooner than they'd originally thought, and potentially a different number, if you like, to what they could have previously seen. And so since that conversation, in many ways, it's made my life way easier because we have this singular focus, this singular goal to drive towards the thing that get the right exit point. And as you said, you know, so we're actually in the middle of the process right now to hopefully achieve that for them. And kind of, you know, in many ways, hopefully by the time this podcast airs, we'll have completed that transaction. Never say never, but that's the intention.
Well, interesting. So we can maybe have a retrospective when we see what happened. This is before the live from the front line right now. So tell me about this MSB business. Like, are there certain, like a traditional service business, like my dad's legal firm, they typically sell for, you know, one times turnover maybe, or, you know, there's well understood metrics. And what are the metrics that people use and that this team now have to concentrate on and that maybe they wouldn't have worried about too much in the past?
Yeah, Yeah, so the metrics are the multiples of EBITDA, and at the size that they are, the realms that we're talking about is the range would be somewhere between 7 times and 10 times EBITDA would be the structure of the deal. And this is the thing that, you know, really kind of gets someone excited, because they can see this profit number irrespective of, you know, your understanding of the of what that number actually means and why it is that number. But so we're able to review performance on a month by month basis. Where are we tracking? What's the run rate? And, you know, some of the things that make a difference in terms of which end of the spectrum you're at is, firstly, what is the headline number? What is the total 12-month number? And is that in 7 figures, 8 figures? You know, what is the size and scale of it? And then what people would talk about in terms of quality of earnings. So how much of that income, how much of that margin is contracted and recurring versus how much of it is one-off? So difference between your support desk, how many, you know, effectively how many users are we supporting, where it's a contract, what subscriptions have you got that are contracts, versus how much of it is a more ad hoc, we need 10 new laptops today. So we've got these various things that you can look at and just go, where are we at? And it's a real clarity to what you're focused on.
So when you're sitting down, let's say they're pitching for a business and they're doing the proposals for a new business, do they, have they switched from going, well, this could be an extra, whatever, 20 grand a year in revenue, or are they now thinking about things, well, this is actually, you know, 5 times 7, what's that, 35 grand in enterprise value that we're really chasing here. And so does that change their behavior? Are they going for deals that they might not go before, or are they saying no to deals? Like, is there a stage where, you know, the contributor, I can't say that word, the margin isn't enough to actually make a difference to the EBITDA and you might walk away from it?
Good question. Really good question. I think several things. I'm not sure they're going for deals that they wouldn't have gone for, but I think it's given them a clarity of the difference between getting a contract won and embedded and delivered and solid, if you like, versus, you know, a longer term pipeline view. I think they have some clear walk away points, but also an understanding of commerciality, as in, if it costs some commission to get a deal across the line, but that could be a multiple of, you know, 8 times, say, that number. So understanding the profitability of a proposal, and we understand in finite detail the margin and the profitability at service line by service line level. You know, the P&L has, for those that are interested and for those that it's relevant to, I could give you a margin calculation on about 70 different end services provided to a customer. And so when you're building that proposal, the salesman doesn't necessarily need to know all of that, but they're given parameters to work within that ultimately are driven by the total outcome. And obviously the connection between the direct cost element and the indirect cost element, you know, how many bums on seats do you need to be able to handle the calls that you're likely to get to support? And some of that is driven by experience, and some of that is driven by stuff. And it's just become way more grown up. So, you know, tightening up terms and conditions, tightening up assumptions, tightening up things, and looking at proposition. What are the ways in which you can drive more value from the same customer base? And I think, I guess the other thing that's interesting is placing value on long-term customer loyalty over short-term wins is a bit of a shift. And that, you know, in terms of where the balance of risk sits, the old Pareto 80-20, you know, 80% of value coming from 20% of customers, but what they're very good at, in my opinion, is knowing what size of business they support well. And there's an upper threshold and there's a lower threshold. You know, so you need to be within this size and this scale for us to effectively support you.
So I think this is a good, maybe, I don't know if you'd agree with me, but this is a good case study of where, you know, a traditional business that's grown normally fairly sales focused and, you know, service focused, but, you know, they know that top line basically is what they look at, you know, but then just a slight change of having a CFO on board that's able to actually identify the deals that actually at the end of the day contribute towards that bigger number, which is, let's face it, too complicated to figure out for civilians, right? So we're just, if you're a Neanderthal sales guy like me dragging my knuckles along my CRM pipeline, that's all I ever care about, right? Whereas actually, if I can look at my pipeline differently and say, well, actually, one of these deals is whatever, it's an extra, it's a, one of these deals is a villa in Marbella, if I play my cards right here, even though it doesn't look like it right now, you know, if you can join the dots between those two things.
Yeah, definitely. And I think, you know, so if to kind of sort of somewhat broke my own trumpet, I think, so what the insight that I provide them is that slightly different lens on where your margin comes from, which customers does that margin come from, which services does that margin come from, what, you know, in it, you can't necessarily definitively do this, but what are the things you should try and do more of, and what are the things that you can do less of from a commercial perspective, and what are the drivers of enterprise value for you, and therefore what are the things that you're going to look to control, and what are the things that you don't need to focus on. And I think, again, their instincts are strong, you know, they make good solid commercial decisions the vast majority of the time. In many ways, mine is the layer of icing on the top, and a way of, I think the other thing that I've given them specifically as we've started going through this process is the translation of the finance speak into their world and into the way that they understand the operation of the business. Because they, you know, they understand the operation of the business and the service provision to the customer way more than I do. But I understand the language of the finance way more than they do. And it's about, you know, kind of giving them the tools to be able to articulate things.
Very good. So, Martin, it's been very interesting. Maybe you could tell us a little bit more about who, having listened to this, who should really reach out to you? Like, who's your chef's kiss perfect customer? Is it more managed service providers or others? And how can they do that?
So it absolutely could be another managed service provider, but equally, I certainly didn't class myself as sector specific, or I don't niche in that sense. But what I do enjoy is businesses that are growing or looking to scale and looking to ultimately exit. And I think, you know, so within what time frame, if you're not doing things from 5 years out of an exit, between 5 and 3 years out from an exit, you're probably not going to extract maximum value. So if that's something that kind of rings a bell for someone, that maybe actually I'd like to be walking away in a 3 to 5 year time frame, if you want to maximize the value that you can get from whatever your business is, the badge SME businesses. So, you know, you'll have a firm of accountants that do the compliance stuff. You probably even have some internal finance resource. But what's missing is this more strategic linkage of your goals as an owner with day-to-day performance in the business.
Perfect. I mean, and that's, having done these interviews now, I've come to realize that there's no single hire. Say you're doing 2 to 10 million in revenue, let's call it. There's no single hire that can have a bigger impact on your personal situation as a business owner than a CFO. There's no sales guy that's going to do it. There's no COO. There's no one. It's this missing piece that is critical and huge, and people don't realize the power of it. So, and how can people get in touch with Martin? You, Martin?
Well, so I'm on LinkedIn, happy to connect with people on LinkedIn. And then from there, reach out and have a chat, have a coffee. As I say, I'm based in Yorkshire, but that's not necessarily a constraint in terms of where I work. So yeah, I'd love to chat to people.
Very good. Thanks. And thank you very much for listening. Your special reward for getting this deep into the podcast with me and Martin is to be able to go to procurementexpress.com/newsletter. Now, why would you want to be on our newsletter? Let me give you a few reasons, Martin. You ready? So I know ordinary newsletters out there, no one really reasons, but we've got the most exciting newsletter in the financial world today. Why? Well, because what we do is we bring you from the last week highlights from financial mishaps that other people have gotten wrong. And in the last few weeks, we've had Naomi Campbell in there for accidentally not keeping full oversight of the NGO or the charity that she was running, you know, and got into hot water over that. We've got examples from local government. We've all loved those ones about how spending went to misarray. But then we've got also ordinary day-to-day examples from businesses like yours and mine where spend control wasn't maintained. And it's ended up with people in hot water and sometimes in prison. Now, Of course, you or I wouldn't do that. But at the same time, you know what? I think we can all learn a little from their mishaps. And I think it's worth keeping an eye out on the type of mishaps that can happen. So there all the time, there's new types of embezzlement and fraud scams going on out there. So we keep you up to date with that. And we also cover the basics as well about how you maintain finance control and oversight within an organization. And sometimes these lessons can be inspirational to make sure you don't end up in our newsletter someday. So that's a good reason. And also you get to keep up with all the podcasts we're pumping out, Martin's and all the others that we have. So procurementexpress.com/newsletter, free and especially for you as a reward to getting this deep into the podcast. Thank you very much. Thanks, Martin.
Thanks, James.